Welcome to What If, So What, the podcast where we ask what's possible with digital and figure out how to make it real in your business. I'm Jim Hertzfeld.
And I'm Kim Chopek. We're part of Perficient's digital strategy team, and today we'll ask what if, so what, and most importantly, now what?
One of the world's most famous and successful entrepreneurs, Mark Cuban, is a man with a lot going on. When he's not sitting courtside cheering his Dallas Mavericks NBA franchise, he's hearing pitches and plans from other entrepreneurs on ABC's Shark Tank. And if basketball or business isn't on his mind, he's geeking out and talking neural networks, artificial intelligence, and the importance of coding to everyone's future.
On this show, we interview a lot of business leaders in large companies who are challenged to bring small and startup thinking into their organizations. We've had a couple of genuine entrepreneurs who shared their experiences with us on the podcast, but today we're excited to have one of the most accomplished entrepreneurs around today, Mark Cuban. Mark, welcome to What If So What?
Thanks for having me on, Kim. I appreciate it.
Hey, Mark, when we were preparing for this episode and I had shared the news that we were going to, you were going to join, and I thought it was interesting the response I got, because some people know you as the Shark Tank guy, other people know you as the Mavs owner. You've done a lot. Yeah, how do you introduce yourself if you were to do that?
Usually owner of the Mavs, guy on Shark Tank, and entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
Because you said people know me from Shark Tank more now than they know me from the Mavs.
Right.
But the sports fans get upset if I don't mention the Mavs. And what I really think of myself is as an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Great. I think we felt the same way. Let's dive into a few questions that we have for you. I'm so excited to have your perspective on this, because people do know you from different parts of their lives and throughout the things you've done as an entrepreneur. But I actually knew about you from your early days in the mid-90s in the dot-com era, and you helped launch broadcast.com. And there was so much going on in those days. And I think when we think about technology being applied in different ways, in this case, the way a business could operate and behave differently, and how a business could be created that didn't exist before with a new model, what was on your mind? What did you see in that model in those days? Did you see it as a great business or a novel idea, or just a great way to get the technology off the ground? Like, what came first in your mind?
I looked at it as a business. I mean, my first company was a company called Micro Solutions when I was in my 20s. And we did local area network systems integration. I wrote software. And we were one of the largest in the country at what we did. And we were profitable every single month of our existence. And I was proud of that. And so when we started AudioNet, which turned into broadcast.com, it was my money that was we initially invested. And so I looked at profitability as the first goal. And it's funny, you know, looking back at the things that I thought could generate cash flow for us, you know, I thought, okay, well, what if we went to Amazon and we were like the Muzak while people browse for books on Amazon, you know, where you can listen to reviews and music or whatever. And obviously it evolved very, very quickly as we figured out what people wanted to listen to, where, when, and why. But it was always about the business opportunity. And that's really the way I look at things. And that's left me at odds a lot of times, honestly, with people in Silicon Valley who, you know, I don't like to invest or start businesses where you have to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to do tens of millions of dollars in business and hope somebody buys you.
You're back to Shark Tank. When I started watching Shark Tank, the one thing that really stuck with me is, as we watch the deals unfold, is looking at sales. I see that question come up all the time. Well, what are your sales today? And it's something actually we've brought into our consulting practice, which is, what are you guys doing today? Who's going to buy this? Who's going to use this product? So it's great to hear that.
No company has ever existed over the long haul without sales. And no company has ever excelled where the top management, particularly the founder and or CEO, wasn't the best salesperson. You don't necessarily have to be the one closing the sales, but if you don't believe enough in your product or service to be so excited about it that it's all you want to talk about, then you're not going to do very well.
Yeah. And who wants it, right? Who's going to buy it anyway? Something we talk about a lot, Mark, and it sort of feels a little abstract sometimes, this idea of empathy, but it's really kind of even knowing who the market is. Like, what do people want? It's interesting to hear you say you had ideas, but you had to really listen to what, you know, what do people want to listen to? What do they want? What problems are they trying to solve?
You got to figure out what business you're in, right? And what your product is and why people will buy it. And sometimes it doesn't turn out to be exactly what you thought it would be when you started a business. As it grows, as it becomes more established, hopefully, you know, sometimes you have to listen, but sometimes you have to not listen, right? You have to know where you want to take it, because the customer's job is not to tell you where your product should go. Our customer's job is to do what's best for their business while you try to help them do even more and help them become even a better business.
There's an old Henry Ford quote, if he gave them what people asked for, faster horses, right?
Exactly.
You know, just speaking of customers and switching sort of from business to customers, I know, and related to the Mavs, we work with some sportswear companies. We've had to go pretty deep in understanding the fan mentality and what it means to be not just a customer, but a fan. And we learned a lot from that experience. And I think certainly technology has changed that, not just from a, you know, promotion and a merchandising and a sales perspective, but the whole experience of being a fan. How does that affected your tenure at the Mavs? How does technology change the way that you become and grow as a Mavs fan?
First thing you have to know is that not every fan connects to a sports team the same. For some people, it's about the live experience going to a game that they may not watch on television. For others, they may not be about going to the game. They may only watch on TV. For others, particularly kids, you know, Gen Z in particular, they may never watch TV, and their exposure is, you know, getting highlights on TikTok or YouTube or Snapchat or Instagram. And you have to understand how you connect to each and every one of them. And that's an ongoing challenge, right? Because the way you connect and the way people consume our product or products is ever evolving. And so it's a nonstop learning process. And to me, you know, the key factors are curiosity. We have to always be curious about how our customers are consuming and what they see or want from us, and agility, because it's ever changing. You know, it may be because of COVID. It may be because of the demographic. It may be because of other technologies that influence. It may be changes, you know, like we saw with privacy from iOS and how we recognize or even see or understand who our consumers are. And so it's just an ongoing challenge in a good way that we can continue to learn from.
Yeah, we certainly see that all the time, Mark. And you know, how do we use data when we can't get the data and then making sense of it in real time? I think that'll certainly kind of get into our AI discussion in a couple of minutes. But yeah, I think we're hearing a lot about that.
I'm curious, Mark, when you're talking about, you know, the different types of expectations fans bring to the table, that's spot on. How does your team go about collecting fan experience so you really can think about your different communities?
We don't do enough of it, right? Because our biggest customer literally is television, which doesn't give us information on who our biggest consumers are, we're starting to create more and more workarounds to collect information. And we're trying to create different value chains for those customers. And one of the newest examples is we created a site called MavsCollectibles.com, and it's a partnership with Ticketmaster. And what it allows us to do is any Mavs fan, if you're a season ticket holder or you buy a ticket through the Mavs and Ticketmaster, since Ticketmaster is our ticket provider, and then you go to a game and you scan your digital ticket in, we deliver to your Ticketmaster account a NFT of a Mavs legend. And so that accomplishes a couple things. Historically, you would have, like, if a family was going together, there'd be one Ticketmaster account and you would just scan in five tickets. And we know five people attended, but it would be all under Jim's name or Kim's name or Mark's name. And we wouldn't know the individual attendees. And so with this distribution of the NFT, we made it so that there would be only one NFT distributed per Ticketmaster account. And in our FAQ and our sales reps, et cetera, we explained to people, if you have four other people coming with you, you want to get them all to set up their own account so that they can get their own NFT. And that enhances and expands our database. But the other thing that it does that is really exciting to us and really the big upside, we're not selling those NFTs independently. For the most part, we do some seeding things, but for the most part, the only way to get that NFT is by actually attending a game. And that starts to create a whole economy of attendees to a sporting event. And because you can only get it if you go to the game, those people who want to collect these, and even a few who want to speculate, are making offers to buy the NFTs from the attendee. The people who have them, and that's starting to create its own little economy around these NFTs, so that you've had some people, and I don't want to say a lot, but some people who have been able to sell their NFTs for more than they paid for their ticket. And so it starts creating a different economy, a different perspective. And we've done this only on a soft launch type basis. Our customers that attend the games know about it, and those who are crypto literate are into it. And we talk to them on our Discord server. But it's just an example of things we're trying to do to connect, to create a unique type of economy for attending games. And as we learn more and expand out that database and we'll be able to use that if we ever start selling the streams of our games to direct consumer. We'll be able to expand that economy to include merchandise and other things. And it gives us, not only enhances the Ticketmaster database, which we share, but it allows us to start connecting directly via the NFTs, which have their own properties. And it's very analogous to the opportunities we saw in the early days of streaming and the early days of the internet. You know, Steve Jobs famously said, everything's a remix. He took technology that already exists and packaged it differently to create the Mac. And the same kind of thing is happening here. We're packaging things differently and combining things like NFTs that already exist, but they allow us to platform in new directions. And that also starts to accommodate some of the younger fans who are more in tune to this stuff and gives us more of a direct connection to them that's harder to get from our traditional channels.
I got to say, that's so innovative, and it's exciting to hear how your team is innovating on those fronts. But I am also equally impressed, Mark, with how hands-on you seem to be. I have to say, we've talked with a lot of leaders and not so many are as hands-on as you seem to be.
Oh, I love this stuff. That's the whole thing. That's why I do what I do. I mean, I love technology. I love learning. I love to compete. I love to show all the 21-year-olds who think they know everything that I'm going to kick their ass, right? Back when I started, I was the young one trying to kick everybody else's ass. Now it's just like, oh, you know, you can't do this stuff. I'm like, watch me.
That's excellent.
I think those are parenting tips, Kim. I think we probably should, listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mark, that is the best practical application of NFTs I've heard yet. So,
it really is.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
You know, NFTs are just proof of concept for what smart contracts can do in the crypto universe. And so I think with crypto, and particularly as it applies to businesses right now, it's really hard to separate the signal from the noise. You know, the noise is all the speculation that happens on Bitcoin and everything else, right? Ethereum and Dogecoin and all that. That's all fun. And those are all community builders and interesting. And you can speculate like you can on stocks, whatever. But that's separate from what you can do with the applications and the smart contracts. And the way I look at it as an entrepreneur, and this applies whether you're a big company or a small company, you know, if I'm starting a company, I'm asking myself, just like in the early days of the internet, it went from, if I'm starting a company, how can I use the internet to give myself a competitive advantage? Now I'm looking at smart contracts. I'm looking at validator nodes. I'm looking at decentralization. I'm looking at decentralized autonomous organizations. I'm saying, okay, can those give me a competitive advantage and maybe a cost advantage? When we started audionetbroadcast.com, we had thousands of servers to stream audio. Then that all went to the cloud. That was a significant differentiation and cost savings and process improvement. Now, when you look at blockchain and validator nodes, not to get too geeky, but proof of stake type blockchains, then you can see, okay, now things we do on the cloud for smaller companies in particular now, you can distribute onto nodes and have triggers with smart contracts that make it cheaper to start a company. And now that we're seeing more employee empowerment using decentralized autonomous organizations, you can even allow for even more employee autonomy or stakeholder autonomy. And how does that change how we create businesses? Just like I looked at, okay, what can I stream to create a competitive advantage? And we went to like Motorola, to use one example. And Motorola in 1994, when they wanted to do an employee-wide program or talk, an all-hands type thing, they literally would rent movie theaters and use satellite and get people to sit in seats in the movie theaters and using satellite project it. And then by 1996, they were just streaming to desktops using broadcast.com. And taking that same, what can I disrupt with this new technology? I'm looking at blockchain and smart contracts the same way. And so once you eliminate all that noise, like when you look at the collectibles market with NFTs, those are just proof of concepts for smart contracts. And what got my attention on NFTs, so like using the Mavs as an example, we can give these NFTs away for free to each attendee that scans in. And they're allowed to sell them on mavscollectibles.com or OpenSea or whatever Polygon, because we use the Polygon blockchain because it's cheaper. But every time they do, we get a royalty on it. So even though I'm giving these away, for anybody who wants to speculate and anybody who wants to resell and any economy that gets built up, I'm making anywhere from 10 to 20% of that resale value. Now, it's not a lot of money yet, but it's money.
Yeah. And, you know, the kind of related to what you're talking about, Mark, at Perficient, of course, we're about helping our customers innovate to achieve their growth objectives. On Shark Tank, you see all sorts of business ideas. But is there any one, especially thinking about what you just said, that stands out as particular creative or clever in terms of how technology was leveraged? And maybe you're thinking about that long tail, that long-term possibility.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them, obviously. We see, you know, 200 companies every season. You know, I'll give you one example that I did. It involves pivoting. It was a company called Panoramic, and they wrote some software that this was in, I don't even know, 2016, maybe, when I think it was the iPhone 5 at the time. And the iPhone 5 had a flat base that allowed you to stand it on a smooth surface. And they wrote software that using the sensors in there, it would trigger the phone to turn, and they would take pictures, continuous pictures, and stitch them into a panoramic picture or panoramic view. And it was called cycloramic. Well, then the iPhone changed its form factor. And so we had to pivot, and they pivoted into computer vision. And we then brought in a new CEO that the founder worked with and pivoted to using that computer vision for the auto industry. Fast forward a few years. Now, if you go to Carvana and you look to buy a car and you can, you know, touchscreen, touch a car and twirl it and open the doors, that is because of Cycloramic that came on Shark Tank pivoting to computer vision, and Carvana bought them to enable that.
Wow. And it takes a lot to be that agile.
Oh, yeah. Agility is everything in the technology industry.
Definitely.
As you guys know, right? If you're not agile, you don't have a business.
That is definitely right. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. The option to change your mind.
That's right. And finally, you know, Mark, something that we know is very important to you and something that's equally as important to Perficient, your foundation started an AI bootcamp to build the next generation of technical talent. Tell us about the bootcamp a little bit, and more specifically, why AI was the focus and why that's so important to building our future.
I think AI is the foundation for all things that we're going to be doing as a country going forward, as businesses going forward. And AI has already started to bifurcate into AI haves and AI have nots, whether they're companies or individuals. And particularly with lower income schools, there aren't any programs to teach us. So, you know, through my foundation, we started the AI bootcamp, and I'm really, really appreciative of your support. You guys have been amazing. And we wanted to go out there and create as many camps as we could where we could introduce AI to high school kids who otherwise would not be exposed. And we have trained hundreds of kids each year, and we'll continue to grow it and do more and more. And we've seen some kids really start to blossom, you know, going to college and taking it on as a focus or a major and just doing amazing things, starting to write applications. And so AI is a foundation to the competitive aspect of business, nation states, you name it. And we really wanted to make sure kids who would otherwise not have access, got access.
Mark, I think it's great as a sort of a gateway to technology today. I know my daughter, who just graduated college, I sort of forced her. This is one of the things she listened to me about. But I forced her to learn code, learn Excel pivot table, if that's where you want to start. You know, HTML, SQL, I'll take it. And she kind of made her way into AI and, you know, really helped her land a great job. I'm really excited for her. But, you know, I just think it's an accessible area in a lot of ways. Just what we found out with in our family was the access to the data sets, the number of projects out there. I think what you're doing is so great because it really goes beyond just the STEM approach, right? The sort of organized STEM. And we need these kinds of things to grab the interest of kids. And
we just want to juice their creativity, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic way to put it. I think that's what we've seen in our experience is it's very accessible. It's achievable. And, you know, once you get the hang of it, if you will, once you kind of get warmed up to it, then the ideas start to come out.
Exactly. You know, at the lowest level, AI is easy, right? Particularly, you can do it in a spreadsheet. There's some features that are in Excel and some others. But once you have a basic understanding of even JavaScript, but, you know, particularly Python and some of the libraries, you can do the basic things very easily. You know, it's when you start to do bigger and crazier applications that it starts to get hard. But the more people we have that understand it, the better it is, not only for the companies they work with, not only for them as potential entrepreneurs, but for the country, because whoever dominates AI is going to have a whole lot of power in this universe.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's interesting the pervasiveness of it is that we think of it not as a platform, like, oh, stand up this AI server or access this AI site. It's not like that. I think it's far back to distribution. We could talk about distributed models all day. I love to hear that because I'm seeing that as such a hedge, a risk mitigation hedge or growth hedge, if not an efficiency gain. But it's more complicated than just a single thing. And I think it's because it's so pervasive. Yeah.
Well, yeah. If you look at the top 10 companies in the world by market cap, all but Warren Buffett's company are all dominant in AI. And that's not an accident. If you look at Google and Facebook, Meta, et cetera, Netflix, et cetera, they've been making investments into AI for years now. And they've put themselves in a position where they can make a lot of mistakes and have started to understand how to really make it work. And, you know, what you guys are doing gives everybody else a chance to at least try to play the game, right? Because without that, the chasm between the AI haves and the AI have nots is going to grow. And you talked about your daughter and my kids, whoever can grasp and understand AI and how to implement it efficiently and how to not make mistakes with it, because there's a lot of companies who have made expensive mistakes with it. That's going to be necessary. I mean, without any question at all, because 10 years from now, you know, you talk about the early days of the internet, 1993, no one knew or cared about HTML. And then in 1995 or six, we thought if a 16-year-old kid understood HTML and how to use the internet, they were a genius, right? And if they could use JavaScript, they were a genius. And we'll look at AI comparatively, right? Because now it seems daunting to a lot of people, but over time, the companies that incorporate it the best will be the most successful. Just like there were a lot of companies who were analog and thought, you know what? I don't need this stuff. You know, what the internet, right? What do I need that for?
Yeah.
You know, I'm brick and mortar Sears, you know, and they were dragged kicking and screaming and via the pandemic or not at all online. And companies are going to do the same thing with AI because to scale, it's even more difficult. But those who can grasp it and implement it are going to have a huge advantage, just like in the early days of the internet, when those who were able to incorporate, you know, digital and online changed the game.
Yeah.
It's a great analogy. And especially when you're talking about the kids that are coming to your boot camp, because I would encourage our listeners to go to the foundation's website and watch some of the videos about how excited they're getting. It's the same thing. I got excited that I could make something blank in HTML to see that same excitement with much more complicated technology and the implications of that technology is just really fun to watch and encouraging for the future. Kind of related, and maybe you're getting this question from some of your bootcamp attendees, is AI the key to a successful career? What advice would you give someone just starting their career or kind of maybe in burnout mode?
Well, if you're good with AI, you have a guaranteed job no matter where you want, wherever you want to work. And if you're amazing at AI and you're a leader in the field, you can, you know, write your own ticket. If you want to start a company, people will just write you checks sight unseen. How crazy it is.
I'm taking note of that.
Yeah, right? If you start all over again, that's exactly what I would do. I would just be all AI all the time. And, you know, knowing me, I'd be integrating AI and crypto and incorporating artificial intelligence into my smart contracts. And so there's so many game changers that happen every few years. There's so many platform evolutions. We talked about the early days of the internet, then there was mobile, you know, and then there was AI, and now there's also crypto. All these things are happening every few years and they start bubbling up. And maybe, you know, crypto has been around for a while, but smart contracts literally have only been around for a few years. And so for it to bubble up now is not unusual. AI has been around for 60 years, but the performance of GPUs, graphical processing units that enabled a lot of these models to be run, and then the bonding of those to be able to create enormous trillion, you know, variable models is relatively new as well. And so there's so many incredible changes that are happening that all those changes create opportunity. If you're a big company, it's hard to do because, like you said, most CEOs don't have the grasp of the technology that I do. And so they don't understand it and it's not native to them, particularly if they're in their late 40s, 50s, 60s, right? It's all noise to them. And if you're just AI literate, it's hard to know the business side of it, right? And how to make those decisions and how to incorporate it. And, you know, I always recommend start small, get, you know, small wins to see how it works. Like I've got a company, PriceStack, And all they do, and they're literally 20 years old now. I don't, maybe they're not even 20 yet. And rather than always having to do A/B testing for pricing and alternatives, they create models that help you optimize between your advertising and your pricing to optimize your gross margin dollars. And they're doing great because it solves a low-end problem that everybody can experiment with, see those results and learn from low-cost results and start scaling from there.
Mark, it makes me think of a debate we had internally about what's a data scientist, you know, because you just trigger, like, was it someone who understands the data, knows how to convert it into information, or is it a scientist, somebody who can nerd out on the APIs and the data load? And it's a little bit of both, right? It's even creating new skill sets.
Yeah, I think the data scientist is really the housekeeper, right? It's the person that helps you understand what data you need, how to capture it, how to clean it, what kind of usage it can be and where the risk factors are, particularly in a company where data is siloed in so many different places. You know, how do you create a data lake that is comprehensive for the whole company? And data scientists can be part of that role. And then you have to have AI folks that can start building models and understanding what flavor of AI to use. You know, is it linear? Is it different type of deep learning? Is it a GAN? There's all these different flavors. And then you have to have the business person who says, okay, what's the cost benefit analysis? Because it's really easy with AI to get really pie in the sky. Oh my goodness, this is going to help us. And, you know, we're going to cut our manufacturing costs. We're going to reduce our failures and we're going to be more efficient across the board. And then you realize that unlike a spreadsheet algorithm or some of your existing data products, you can't reverse engineer the output of a neural network. It doesn't tell you how it found the needle in the haystack. So it creates a different level of complexity that you need to have somebody who's very AI literate that also understands your business. Because otherwise, you're just throwing things up against the wall to see if it fits. And it might be an expensive lesson to learn that it does not.
I remember an early sales forecasting system I worked on probably 20 some years ago. And it was awesome. And we had professors and we had smart people and we had everybody and we had all the data. And then the sales managers just overwrote the results. Oh, that was a great lesson.
Yeah.
About how it can come together or not.
And not get used. Yeah. Or not get used correctly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's why there's a market for you guys. If people could create this stuff on their own and not mess it up,
yeah.
We wouldn't need consultants.
Yeah.
Yes. We look for ways to put us out of a job, honestly, Mark. Oh, that's our end goal.
Totally.
You know, hopefully they're so happy they just pay you a lot of money and refer you to the next one. Because there's always another company that needs help.
Yeah. These are great revelations, Mark. Again, thanks for joining us. And I feel like we did a little bit of life history here. We covered a lot of ground in your career. Plus, we need to clear up, who is that guy? Is he Shark Tank guy? He looks like the Mavs owner, right?
So. No, I'm a geek at heart. As you guys can tell, hopefully, that... You know, I love to geek out on this stuff. And, you know, I'm the one that does tutorials. I'm not going to sit here and say I could write a 10,000 layer neural network, guide a company on what to do with their AI. But at the same time, I can tell what's real from what's fake and, you know, my investment and try to give guidance to the companies I do invest in or the people I work with.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad because we were looking for a subcontractor, you know, to do some AI work. So, you know, if you got a little downtime looking for something to do, Mark.
If you get bored, yeah.
I get bored, right? I got nothing to do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Thanks for starting the boot camp. We love being part of it and looking forward to see what these kids are going to do next. I love your vision as well. So anything else you want to share with us today, Mark?
Oh, you guys covered everything. It was great. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Again, thanks for joining us. Have a great holiday. This is mid-December right now.
Yep.
And we hope to talk to you again someday.
I hope so as well. And thanks for your partnership with the Mavs and with the bootcamp. You guys have been incredible.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Take care.
We wanted to take a moment to talk a little more about the Mark Cuban Foundation's AI bootcamps, which Perficient sponsors along with our partners at Microsoft. The AI Bootcamp is a free intro to artificial intelligence for underserved high school students to increase AI literacy and understanding. It takes place over 4 half-day sessions and no prior experience is required to participate. If you're a high school student or know one who is interested in getting a jumpstart on AI, or if your company would like to host a bootcamp, please visit markcubanai.org.
Special thanks to our VP of Marketing, Bill Davis, for producing this episode. And thanks again to Mark Cuban for taking the time to talk with us. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcasting platform. And as always, keep asking what if, so what, and most importantly, now what?
You've been listening to What If, So What, the digital strategy podcast from Perficient with Jim Hertzfeld and Kim Chopek. We want to thank our Perficient colleague, J.D. Norman, for our music today. Subscribe to the podcast and don't miss a single episode. You can find this season along with show notes at Perficient.com. Thanks for listening.